Welcome to the Da Vinci Hour podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Maxwell Cooper, and in this podcast series, I interview physicians, medical innovators, and entrepreneurs making an impact on healthcare. This podcast is produced by Da Vinci Academy, a multimedia medical education company that provides podcasts, video courses, and digital textbooks. You can see more on our website, www.dviacademy.com. and our YouTube channel, youtube.com/c/DaVinciAcademyMed. This podcast is sponsored by Doc2Doc, the personal lending platform designed for doctors by doctors. Do you have some big expenses in the near future? Maybe you're moving, applying to residency or fellowship, fixing up your car or home, or starting a new practice. Doc2Doc believes that traditional lenders overestimate the risk of lending money to doctors, residents, and medical students, focusing too much on the challenges of their financial past and giving them insufficient credit for the promise of their financial future. Check out Doc2Doc's personal loan options at doctodoclending.com/DaVinci. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Da Vinci Hour podcast. I am joined this week by Dr. Alana Arnold, a pediatric emergency medicine physician in Miami, Florida, and the founder of Premier Pediatric Solutions. So Dr. Arnold, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Maxwell. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, maybe give us a little bit of some background on who you are, like where you went to school, where you did your training, and maybe kind of a general overview of your clinical practice as well.
Yes, absolutely. So I am originally from Philadelphia, born and raised. I did my undergrad at Princeton University. And for medical school, I went to Tufts University up in Boston. Thereafter, pretty much I did a tour of the US for my medical training. I went over to Children's Hospital Oakland for my pediatrics residency, and then rounded out my training for fellowship at Texas Children's Hospital down in Houston. So I've been around the country and seen how different systems work, different patient populations. So that was definitely a big bonus for me because I wanted to make sure that I got a lot of exposure, built up my medical and clinical acumen for pediatric emergency medicine. I was able to feel comfortable in any setting. So I feel like that I accomplished that given I was at these huge academic centers and got a lot of experience during my training. I'm currently down in Miami serving as a medical director for a community site in North Miami Beach as the pediatric emergency medicine medical director there. I've been here for about 2.5 years, and my goals have been essentially to raise the bar for appropriate pediatric emergency medicine care in the community setting without having families need to go to the major pediatric hospital hub downtown. So we've made lots of inroads and accomplished a lot in terms of making sure that the staff is properly trained on pediatric emergency medicine cases, their medical knowledge in general about pediatrics, how to approach the pediatric patient when they come into the ER, making sure we have proper equipment on hand, pretty much anything you can think of in terms of what we call pediatric readiness I've been involved in, and making sure that we've developed the protocols and content and processes needed to make sure that our ER is running smoothly. So that's what's been keeping me busy clinically so far over the past couple of years.
That's awesome. Yeah. And quite a diverse training background as well, which is really cool. I'm curious to be a pediatric ER physician, can you also just do adult ER residency and then do a pediatric fellowship? Is that another route to that as well?
Yes, absolutely. Good question. A lot of people ask that. So yes, there are two routes. So you can either do pediatric residency like I did and then do a 3-year fellowship for pediatric emergency medicine. Or you could do an adult ER residency, which can be 3 or 4 years, depending on the program you're at, and then do a 2-year pediatric emergency medicine fellowship. I knew very early on that I did not care for adults. And so I always loved dealing with the kids. And that's what made me do pediatrics residency off the bat and then do my secondary training for fellowship with pediatric emergency medicine.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think I'm sure we'll get more into this as we talk about your business is from my understanding, like I know here at Emory, the ER residents will rotate over at our children's hospital. So I think tell me if I'm wrong, but I think they get some training, but not maybe like so they could handle basics or even just are aware of pediatric emergencies, but it seems like it may be kind of limited from what I've heard.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so that's exactly it. My consulting work for Premier Pediatric Solutions focuses around that. To give perspective, right? So let's say you have an ER resident, they have a 3-year training program. The majority of those are not based at children's hospitals where they're, you know, readily accessible. As you mentioned, most of the time they have to rotate to get any pediatric training. But say even in the best of worlds, they're at a medical facility, academic center that has a children's hospital, which is the minority of training cases for adult ER residency. It's out of a 3-year training program, so you know, you're looking at 36 months, they may have 2, 3, maybe 4 months that are pediatric focused. Most times they'll have 1 or 2 dedicated months in a pediatric ER, and then they'll do maybe a month of PICU. So honestly, we're talking perhaps 10 to 15% of their training focuses on pediatrics, which anyone, you know, if you just look at trying to be proficient and certainly competent, you need 10,000 hours, right? At least to become proficient in something. And that's just not what they're getting. So these residents go through their training, they get a taste of pediatrics, depending if they're at a pediatric hospital, you know, the level certainly should be higher in terms of the clinical knowledge, but it's the exposure and volume that is typically the issue. And also knowing the broad spectrum of pathophysiology for children. Children and how they get sick and how they present is categorically different from adults. So if you do not have that background of pediatric residency to see what a sick baby looks like versus a sick 14-year-old, or how they're going to compensate in terms of their vital signs or metabolic disturbances, it can be quite challenging. And that's exactly where I fill that gap, because these clinicians are then tasked with dealing with anything that walks through the door in the ER, which can certainly happen, but they have very limited medical training on pediatrics and also the resuscitation of children as needed, depending on the clinical picture. And so the vast majority of children, like 80% of them, so 4 out of 5 kids, are actually going to their neighboring ERs or urgent cares. Just how the layout of hospital systems are in this country, there's only about 5% children's hospitals. And so the odds are a child's going to go to their neighborhood ER and be cared for by maybe a mid-level PA or an NP or an ER doctor. And these clinicians just don't have the same amount of training as a pediatric emergency medicine doctor who's done at least 6 years of training, 3 years of pediatric residency and 3 years of the pediatric emergency medicine fellowship. This then makes for a huge gap in clinical knowledge, which will then lead to poorer care, poorer outcomes, increased morbidity, mortality for the patient. And, you know, really very unfortunate things happening to kids in our communities. And so my consulting work focuses on going into these sites, bridging the gap with clinical simulations that are very focused and high yield in terms of process-driven results. So making sure not only their medical knowledge is being addressed, but what are the team dynamics? How is a room oriented and set up to optimize the care, right? A lot of people, you know, you go into a hospital, it's typically freezing, right? It's like 5 degrees in a hospital. That is actually extremely detrimental to a pediatric patient. You actually want your resuscitation room, at least ambient temperature or warmer, right? It goes back to the pathophysiology. So all of these things we address and really are focused on in terms of team dynamics, making sure they have proper equipment, all of that, and making sure that they're going to optimize their pediatric care when they see those sick children. And we have been able to see incredible results in terms of 7-fold increase in revenue and cost savings for the hospitals we have entered and worked with. This stems from you're having more efficient care delivered. You're able to determine when a child is very sick and out of your depth or scope of care. So initiating transfers sooner when it's medically necessary. And then simple things, right? Foreign body retrieval. We just the other day I was working and a little girl stuck beads up her nose, right? We had transfers, you know, between three facilities this family had gone to because they, one, did not know how to approach a five-year-old in a comfortable way to make sure that they're calm enough to allow the procedure to be done. And two, they did not have the proper size pediatric equipment to retrieve the foreign body. So we, after we're able to train these sites and do our simulations and make sure that the clinical care is up to par, we've been able to decrease transfers and save money for these facilities because they feel comfortable with dealing with pediatric patients. They have the proper equipment on hand. So it's really been a win-win in terms of delivering better care to the children that they're encountering, which is the majority of the population. Over 30 million kids pass through ER systems each year, and also optimizing their care and being more efficient. So they have increased volume and are making revenue in that way. A secondary component, which is most important to me, is that the clinicians also feel more confident. We've had probably 2 to 3-fold increase in clinical competency for both the physicians, but also the nurses, feeling more comfortable with identifying sick children, how to approach the sick child, and initiating those interventions that are going to be important and life-saving for them.
That's amazing. Those are some amazing results you've demonstrated. And I mean, it makes sense if you're not trained in it or limited training in it, you're not just not going to be as competent. I mean, it's the same thing like in my field of radiology, we do, and we have the privilege here. We do have a large academic children's hospital, but we only rotate a few months. So if you don't do a fellowship in it, you know, it's the old, if you don't use it, you lose it kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And so I imagine it happens in other fields as well. So, and I think you also hit on another good point. It's not just the doctors, it's, you know, the nursing staff, the ER staff, you know, being aware. And then, you know, there's things that you're going to be aware of that I think most people, like you said, like the room temperature, like I would have never thought of that. I think it's probably simple things in your world, but yeah, you know, are obvious things, but there's, I think even just pointing out things like that, that, you know, may seem trivial, but probably make a big difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's just having that lens of having pediatric emergency medicine training, those extra 3 years to really know, to be an expert in the field, actually, you know, and making sure that, you know, not every clinician knows everything all the time. So we serve as a full suite pediatric emergency medicine consultation group and focusing on the clinical component to make sure that the setting where these children are being received is pediatric ready with proper equipment, proper standardized vetted protocols that have been, you know, created in these huge, fantastic children's academic settings that are around the country. But unfortunately, that information is very siloed. It's not disseminated into the community. So we bridge that gap from having your pediatric emergency medicine expertise, academic centers, knowledge, bringing it to the community to make sure that they have access to those protocols, understand what needs to be done, know when they're out of their depth and needing to transfer a patient, know how to approach and stabilize a sick patient. And so all of these types of supports are critical to make sure that the children are going to receive proper care, because at any point, anyone who works in the ER knows that anything could walk through the door at any time. So you want to make sure that you are prepared to stabilize, recognize someone who's very sick and out of your scope. And that's exactly what we do through the simulations, and making sure that they have proper protocols and equipment in place.
That's great. Maybe could you walk us through a little bit about these simulations that you go through with your clients, and kind of like what that entails, and does it involve the doctors, the staff, the nurses, everybody, and kind of how that works out?
Yeah. So baseline, I love simulations. I think that it is a fantastic tool for training for clinicians. You and I both know you're still going through your training. Medicine is very dynamic and it's changing constantly. So as you mentioned, if you don't use it, you lose it. You have to stay on top of your game in terms of exercising those muscles of your mind to make sure that you know how to care for the patient. So typically our standard is always doing a needs assessment. So we come in and say, okay, what are the state of affairs at this facility? For example, it could be an urgent care in a suburban location. They might have 20-25% of their patient population be pediatrics. Very commonly, there's going to be a mid-level, maybe a couple mid-levels, depending on the volume, and an ER doctor. Again, it's exceedingly rare that these private companies are going to staff a pediatrician, let alone a pediatric emergency medicine trained doctor. So typically it's a PA and NP and or ER doctor who are staffing these facilities. So we come in, do a needs assessment. What are your goals for the care? How many procedures or types of procedures would you want to do? Do you feel comfortable with doing laceration repairs, for example? A lot of people, non-pediatric trained clinicians, get extremely anxious about this because it's like, okay, I have a screaming toddler. How am I going to approach trying to fix a lip laceration on this kid? If you cannot do sedation or proper analgesia, all bets are off. This laceration repair will not go well, and you're going to end up transferring the child. So coming in, doing a needs assessment in terms of what is the baseline medical knowledge of the staff. We have a survey that we give to all clinicians out on the site to get their baseline pediatric knowledge. So that's established. And we can see, okay, where the huge deficits are. For example, if you have only one ER doctor on and two PAs, and the PAs, you know, hit marks where they feel extremely uncomfortable with pediatric care, that's something that needs to be addressed, and we'll speak with the leadership about that, because even with the best of simulations and clinical acumen, we're not miracle workers. And so it would behoove the client to say, you know what, maybe I need to hire on mid-levels who have more pediatric experience to boost their baseline knowledge. So once we have that baseline knowledge in terms of medical and clinical acumen and around pediatrics, we have an understanding for the capabilities of the facility and what they want to do in terms of medical care or procedures, which is very common for kids. Like something along your alley would be, are they having imaging on site, for example? What does that process look like if you're getting x-rays? Who's reading them? Is it a pediatric radiologist, or is this someone who's doing the remote work? And then do they have a network to refer the child appropriately if there's an intervention that needs to be done? So after the baseline needs assessment is completed, we develop a plan. The vast majority of our clients are saying, we need better clinical acumen. We need to learn how to care for the pediatric patients in a proficient, efficient, and thorough way. And also importantly, know when we need to transfer and when we're out of our scope of practice. So I have developed a suite of 6 high yield process-driven simulations. They hit the most common medical scenarios that are going to enter the urgent care or emergency room in your communities. They range from anaphylaxis to severe asthmatics to drowning scenarios, medical resuscitations, et cetera. For example, if we take asthma is a super common medical complaint. Children typically have respiratory complaints to have them seek medical care, which is different from adults, which are typically primary cardiac medical issues that get them into trouble. So assessing how to recognize signs of respiratory distress and trouble breathing are critically important for adult trained doctors, because it is different in a child. A child could be talking to you in full sentences and breathing way too fast, but if you don't register what a normal respiratory rate is for a child, you might miss that. So for asthma, for example, we will have a core group of the staff perform the simulation. The ideal number for our group, as we found, is 5. 5 is a good number just because it allows all of the roles to be covered in terms of who's going to be team lead, who's going to be the recorder, who's giving medications, who might be managing the airway, et cetera. But it's also intimate enough where people don't feel overwhelmed and they're going to speak up if they are unsure about what to do next, or they feel like they don't know what's going on. To your point, we include everyone on staff. It's critically important when you're talking about elevating pediatric care that every single person who is in that facility is on board and well-versed, every clinician. So that includes physicians, that includes nurses, that includes techs. Everyone who's going to lay hands on this patient needs to participate in the simulation to be the best team player possible. I have seen nurses who are more empowered speak up when something concerning was happening, and it's really, you know, saved a child's life. And so we really focus on making sure that every team member is involved in the simulation. So we have our physicians, nurses, the techs, the group of five, and we go through a first run through in terms of a medical scenario that we'll present. So asthma, for example, and we, as they are running through the clinical scenario that I've developed, I'm giving them medical knowledge feedback. So first intervention may be someone says, okay, let's give oxygen. And the response may be, all right, so the child is not hypoxic. They're having an asthma exacerbation. The primary thing is to get them a beta agonist, something like albuterol. So giving that real-time feedback as they're running through the simulation. Also, making sure that the team dynamic is appropriate. If you've ever been in a resuscitation or a code, the team dynamic is everything. So making sure that there is clear, concise, closed-loop communication is essential when you have these higher acuity, higher risk, higher stakes, stressful situations, because you want to make sure that every team member is on the same page for their clinical care. So that is something that we emphasize to make sure that every team member is directing their responses and actions to another team member, and that is closed loop. So if I say give 20 cc bolus of normal saline, I'm directing that to John. John is going to say, okay, Dr. Arnold, giving 20 cc per kilo bolus now, so that everyone is on the same page to understand that the task is being addressed and completed, so there's no loose ends. So the first run through, we do just building the medical knowledge and team dynamics. Also, equipment and spatial orientation of the room is really important. A lot of the sites that we encounter that don't have pediatric specialists on staff have issues with this, right? So I mentioned already the temperature of the room is an issue that they would otherwise not know about. Making sure they have appropriately sized equipment. Children come in all different sizes. So you have to have someone who is pediatric emergency medicine trained to vet the type of equipment you need to have on hand. The worst feeling in the world is having a sick child and knowing that there's a $2 equipment, say endotracheal tube, for example, that would be really, really beneficial right now, but you don't have it because someone didn't know to order it because it's not a pediatric facility. So things like that, making sure they have proper equipment on hand is critically important. So we vet their inventory and supplies essentially. And then also, how is the room set up? So making sure the head of the bed is has all the appropriately sized suction devices for a child. So you wanna have suction devices from something you can use in a baby on up to a teenager or more or less adult size. Making sure all of that is easy access so that they can use it immediately. Most people get in trouble with codes, be it pediatric or adult, because they're anxious, they're frantic, it's stressful. It's a very, emotional situation when you're actively trying to save someone's life. That is very understandable. What our group focuses on is not only delivering the medical knowledge, but making it as seamless as possible so that the equipment is right there at your fingertips that you can use appropriately to make sure the patient is cared for. So having suction and airway devices readily available, always in the same location at the head of the bed, helps mitigate that in terms of stress and people forgetting where things are. Simple things like having the Breslow and the Breslow cart. This is a tool that was developed to have children estimated weights just by using a measuring tape, essentially, that's been standardized. So having that on site and ready on the bed, for example, is critically important, because you can't imagine how many times a child's come in to a resuscitation bay. It's easy for me to guess a child's weight. I see children all day. But someone who's not a pediatrician, they see a kid, they're like, I have no idea how much this kid weighs. So now I don't know how much medication I need to give. Everything is weight-based in pediatrics. So having that ancillary equipment, the Breslau tape, it takes off that cognitive burden, again, relieving that extra stressor in a high-stakes situation. So once you have that tape, you can estimate the child's weight just by measuring their height. And then you know which medications to give. So it's color coded. So say the child lands in the red zone, say, okay, we're going to be working in the red zone. And here are the doses that we'll need. The other component is making sure they have access to proper protocols. There are great academic centers around the country that have gone through all the research and standardized protocols in terms of care. So for example, the asthma, as I've mentioned, there's no reason why an adult ER doctor should have to reinvent the wheel. So our job is to give them access to these standardized protocols, again, to ease that burden and that cognitive load of, okay, I've given albuterol, I've given some steroids, what next? What are the next steps and plan of care for a patient who can be very sick, for example, from asthma? So those are kind of the four or five components that we always work through initially, as well as the medical content in the simulation. We run through that once I do an immediate, as they call it, real-time debriefing with the staff to, again, discuss how the team dynamics worked, how the movement of the room worked, were they able to access the appropriate equipment in a timely fashion, how the communication worked in terms of closed loop communication, and how their baseline medical knowledge was of the case. Once I'm able to give that feedback, hear their thoughts, concerns, and whatnot, we run through the simulation again with me taking more of a backseat approach and seeing how they're going to take that real-time feedback and then incorporate it in their clinical case. So after having these sessions, we do usually 2 to 3 run-throughs and simulations per case. I then have a post-intervention, so post-simulation survey to see where they are landing and if there are any other deficits that we need to address. Typically, so if we're just looking at, say, there's a group of 5 in an urgent care that we're training, typically after one simulation, the ideal spacing of having the next simulation is on a weekly basis. You have to give people time to kind of absorb the information and feel well-versed in it, and then introduce a new topic. So that's what we've found in terms of having the process-driven simulations on a weekly basis. We have a suite of 6 of them. And so it would take, you know, on the order of 6 weeks to go through the simulation course that we've developed for one group of 5. And at each time, making sure they have the pre-simulation assessment and then a post-simulation assessment. On a larger and longer term scale, we then check in on, depending on how the client feels, either on a bi-monthly or maybe quarterly or perhaps even semi-annual basis. I try to keep it quarterly just to make sure that their skills are still fresh, that they're not losing any of the gains that they've had with simulations. And so we kind of have them in a loop of checking in, feedback, tweaking anything that they are unsure about. And that's kind of the process we march through when we're doing the process-driven simulations with the client.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it's extremely thorough. And I remember I did a rotation in the ER at the county hospital here when I was an intern. And what was very impressive to me was how the ER is very good at like running codes and things. I feel like on the floor codes are kind of chaotic. And I feel like the ER...
Very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I feel like the ER is a crazy place, but I feel like you guys are very good at, you know, just one, because you do it so often. And then, you know, you guys, you know, it's just part of your training and part of your simulations. So I think that's incredible. And I think bringing this to these centers and helping them, you know, adapt that to a pediatric population is great. I'm curious from a standpoint of how are you marketing the business? And like you mentioned those dramatic cost savings and more efficient workflow, I guess, how are you marketing the business? And like, how do you, if like a hospital's maybe like, you know, they think, oh, this is kind of interesting. Maybe they're not quite sure. Or they're skeptical. Like, how do you convince them, say like, hey, like, you know, you should really try this out, like try out our services. And I think this will really benefit. So how do you kind of mitigate that and market yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I have learned very quickly, right, business is business. People will part with their money if they think that they're going to save time or if you're going to make their life easier. Those are kind of like the two mainstays. You can have the best business model, you can have the most fantastic presentation, but if the punchline doesn't deliver in terms of this product is going to make my life easier, or this, you know, product is going to save me some money, or, you know, get me more money, it's very, very hard for people to commit. So thankfully, you know, we've been able to show not only are you going to have tons of cost savings in terms of having a more efficient, proficient ER team and have the clinicians become more competent, but you're going to be more efficient in terms of your care and have increased revenue because you're able to see patients more efficiently once you have your clinical simulations, all the while without having to hire on a whole suite of pediatric ER doctors. So I have been using basically my professional network to leverage different inroads. I'm pediatric ER, but I do know ER physicians for sure. And so trying to leverage their relationships wherever they're working or if they moonlight somewhere has been critically important to get into those connections to speak with urgent care leadership or standalone ERs has been really important. And then also things like this, right? Just trying to increase the visibility and awareness about the pediatric readiness issue in the country. A lot of people, unless you are in emergency medicine and more specifically pediatric emergency medicine, you're not aware of this issue. If you don't have kids, it wouldn't cross your mind. I speak to parents about this all the time. You assume, hey, I'm going to the ER, I have a kid, they're a medical professional, they're going to be good with taking care of the child. They don't know the kind of layers behind that in terms of training, having proper equipment, having standardized protocols, all those things that need to be vetted. They assume that when I step into this medical facility, I'm going to get the best care possible. So increasing the awareness and visibility about the really the dearth of pediatric emergency medicine in the community is critically important. So I actually have been working on having more targeted marketing and branding around some content or maybe ads that are going to highlight the issues in terms of 80% of children are seen by non-pediatric trained physicians. There are only 5% children's hospitals across the nation. All of these types of things, there's a sevenfold increased mortality in Black kids compared to white children for asthma. So things like that, where it is going to increase the visibility of the issues in pediatric emergency medicine in the community and how our product addresses that in terms of building the medical acumen for the clinicians who are seeing the vast majority of children who are non-pediatric trained, but they are seeing the bulk of the kids, and how our product not only increases their competency, but will allow for cost savings for the hospital. So typically I drive it home with, listen, say you have 10 ER staff, you already have them salaried, they're already employed by you. I am going to optimize your staff so that they can better care for kids. You are going to see more efficient care. You're also going to see cost savings because you aren't going to have to transfer as many for lower acuity things, as I mentioned, for example, like foreign body retrieval. And you're also going to see better workflow because once you know what you're doing with the child, you're going to be able to be more efficient and see more patients. Also, in a kind of more cynical but very realistic way, you also mitigate your risk of litigation, right? So if you have proper protocols in place for pediatric care, the odds of the clinician getting into trouble and then having increased mortality or morbidity and higher risk of litigation is going to be mitigated when you have proper training. So it's kind of a return on investment how I market it. So I can say, listen, you have five staff members, and I can guarantee that with our proper training, the process-driven simulations and equipment vetting and standardized protocol, I can guarantee if you follow these steps that you're going to have, a 30% volume increase and return on or increase in revenue after a year, as opposed to you having to go out and find a pediatric ER doctor and pay them, $250K to be on staff, for example. So it's all about the numbers. As you well know, with anything with business, they want to know, how are you saving me money or how are you making me money? And thankfully, I've been able to show that better care is profitable. It will deliver cost savings if you have properly trained staff. You just have to have that initial investment for the training and reap the benefits of those cost savings and increased revenue down the line. And it's obviously ethically appropriate because we're giving better care to kids who absolutely need it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that the better care, hopefully that should be enough. But like you said, business is business. And so I think, these healthcare systems, especially in the COVID era, are always looking for ways to efficiently save money. So it makes sense that it would, to go from that angle. I think, it's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for the staff, absolutely, the patients, the hospital. I'm curious, speaking of business, you're obviously a full-time practicing physician, and then you also have this business, and then you're also a medical director. I'm curious, one, kind of a two-part question. One, how do you balance all of those roles, all those hats you wear? And then two, like, how have you built up your business acumen and business knowledge as a practicing physician? Because as you know, we don't get much of that training in residency.
Absolutely. Yeah. So applying to medical school, I decided to get my MBA at the same time in health management. At the time, there were a few programs where you could be in medical school, do the first 2 years and take a pause and get your MBA. And then come back to finish the final 2 years of medical school. I was lucky to find a program that not only integrated the two, so in a four-year span to have your MD and MBA, but also I enjoyed the program a ton. So that was at Tufts University School of Medicine. And so we were up in Boston. It was integrated such that in the first year of medical school, we had some content in terms of classwork over the first summer before we started our medical school classes, and then had some longitudinal consulting projects, seminars and whatnot, kind of in the second half of medical school to allow us to get the MBA integrated during our 4 years of training. I always knew that I love clinical medicine. I love seeing the kids, and I think children are awesome, but I always had an inclination and interest in business. I'm a big person in terms of processes, how to be efficient, how to optimize things, tweak protocols, et cetera. So that was part of why I liked the ER initially, because there's lots of workflow processes and throughput and things like that. So I knew even going into medical school that I wanted to get that extra training for the MBA in health management to get that kind of leadership information and experience and know how to approach having a functional, well-run ER. So thereafter, I did consulting projects in medical school that allowed me to, travel abroad. We did projects in Brazil, consulting work for a hospital down in Sao Paulo, which was excellent. And that was kind of my first taste of, as a clinician, what needs to be done for the patient, but as a leader, in business, how can we marry the two to make sure that it's financially viable and attractive for a hospital system to do that appropriate clinical management and care? And so as I went through my medical training, things in residency were fairly busy. So I kind of put a pause on my MBA work in a certain regard. But when I was in fellowship, I actually focused on using my MBA for my fellowship project that I was able to later publish. And basically, it focused on how to optimize reimbursement for our pediatric sedations. In the ER setting, kids are always busting up limbs or whatever, and needing procedures done. And a lot of times we're able to give them medication to have them sedated so that we can make manipulations and repair what we need to do. And so what I did was standardize a template that would pull the appropriate medical information that optimized the billing and reimbursement for our hospital. So it was a win-win in terms of, again, standardizing the practice, making sure that clinicians were more efficient in their care, that the template had all the necessary components, which on the flip side would optimize the reimbursement because the billing department had all of the information they needed to then push it to insurance to optimize the reimbursement. So that was a great program that I was able to develop to make sure that, again, we were delivering appropriate medical care and best practice, and also optimizing financially the return for the hospital. So after I did my training, I always had an eye for leadership, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, any clinician, you can only see, you know, certain amount of children in your career. But I knew if possible, I wanted to make longer lasting changes, something more on a systemic level, so that children's lives would be kind of improved broadly. So that's why I always was attracted to leadership, because as a medical director, I can make policies and changes that are going to help improve the pediatric care, even when I'm not on site, even when I'm not on shift. And so for me, that's kind of the major driving factor and why I started this consulting, because I knew that, you know, every physician, every clinician in the medical field, you go into work because you care about what you're doing, you love your job, and you want to do the best that you can. That doesn't always translate into the best care. And so I wanted to at least do my part to say, there are fantastic ER doctors in the community who are great clinicians, they're great people, but they are not afforded the proper tools to be the best that they can with pediatrics. And so I wanted to bridge that gap to say, this is a very structured and high yield way to deliver the appropriate pediatric emergency medicine knowledge to them, so that they feel comfortable to care for these kids, so that while I'm long gone or there's no pediatric ER doctor around, they're able to still do that and give the best care for the child. So when in my medical director role, I was able to do that kind of in my immediate surroundings, in terms of having autonomy to say, these are the simulations we need, these are the supplies that we need, these are, you know, the training sessions and education that needs to be done for every clinician, every team member, to make sure we're delivering proper care. And then pivoting to do that in the consulting work to make sure that the pediatric readiness is being upheld while it is financially viable. So becoming a better clinician and more efficient is helpful, because you're going to see more patients per hour. You're going to be able to have a leaner throughput process. So instead of that child who has, you know, a bead stuck in their ear sitting for hours and having the ear manipulated multiple times with improper tools, our group can come in and say, actually, this device is the best thing you can use. We train them up on how to use it, and they're able to bang out those lower acuity cases quickly. And then also on the flip side, you have a very sick patient. You should not mess around with this. You need to transfer them immediately, recognizing those signs of when a child's sick, to get them to definitive care. So those were kind of the thought processes in terms of my motivations for getting the MBA, so that I could set protocols and policies in terms of leadership to make sure that something's going to be lasting and have children receive the optimal care. And I'm translating that into my consulting work, knowing the vision of not only the medical expertise. I trained at, you know, the largest freestanding children's hospital, not only in the country, but in the world, at Texas Children's. It's level one trauma center, we get huge volume and international patients as well. So that training helped me hone and focus my medical acumen and expertise. But on the other side, having the MBA helps me see broader picture, bigger picture. What are the needs of this client? What are the needs of this facility? And how are we going to bridge it to make sure that we have proper clinical care that's going to be financially viable and even financially attractive once you can set everything in place? So the consulting work really does address that in terms of optimizing the return on investment, essentially, for the client, because they already have their staff, but I'm basically giving them another skill set. I'm augmenting their skill set for pediatric emergency medicine without the client having to go hire a pediatric emergency medicine specialist.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's a great synopsis of kind of how, you know, you did the MBA, which kind of laid the groundwork. And then now it sounds like you kind of did what you're doing now in the consulting work with the medical director role. So that kind of was like the initial steps. And then now you're taking that and, you know, spreading it to the other community hospitals out there. I think that's awesome. I'm curious on your thoughts getting the MBA. Do you think it was helpful you got it during medical school and had it kind of right out of the gate versus, I know some doctors think about going back and getting it later. The problem is, like, I couldn't imagine like trying to do that when you're a practicing physician or a resident.
Yeah, Maxwell, I agree with you 100%. Thankfully, I just had that type of vision. Like, you know, I don't want to be in training forever. Let me get all I can while I am still a student. So that was my approach. And I was happy to find this program that was a joint program for the MD-MBA to get everything done at once. You're kind of fresh and new. We met different people. You know, people come to get their MBA at all different stages of their life with different backgrounds and experiences. And as a student, you know, I was 22, 23, getting this exposure. For me, I was like a sponge. It was super helpful. And I saw immediately how I could integrate this into my career down the line. So personally, I would say, if at all possible, try to get it while you are in medical school. There are more programs now that have it integrated pretty seamlessly. I think once you are out in practice and you know, you've done your residency and maybe a fellowship and you're out in practice, life is just very busy. You might have a spouse, you might have kids, you have other demands on your time that make it much harder to be an adult learner as opposed to someone who's only in training. Like, all I had to do was focus on my medical school and MBA stuff. Now, thinking, you know, the thought of me trying to get an MBA or other academic certificates or degrees at this time is beyond me. I just don't have the bandwidth. And so my two cents would be, if at all possible, I try to get it while you are in medical school. It's certainly reasonable if you figure out that, hey, this is not for you. You can switch your program. But I think that that is the best setting, because it also is nice to have that mentorship, right? So we had a group of 11 students in our medical school who did the joint program. And we had really good mentorship in terms of clinicians who had gone through the program, or people who, you know, for whatever reason had gotten the MBA later in life, but they were able to give us kind of real-time feedback and mentorship while we were in medical school, which I think was invaluable and really helped me develop how I wanted to use this MBA and the vision I had for myself as a clinician and for my career. So my vote would be, get it as soon as you can while you're in training. And it's kind of just more seamless, because you really approach your clinical practice differently, right? So when I was in residency, I was saying, okay, why are we getting this test? Is this test really needed? Is this going to change our management? Because this test, right, costs $500. Like, does this patient actually need this? You can, you know, get a little heady about it when you're in really academic centers. And sometimes it was nice to kind of go back and forth with the attending as to, okay, what is the medical learning for this test? But what is the practicality of this test? And how is it going to change our management and things like that? When you have that lens, it was only because I had gone through the MBA training to know that, you know, this claim may be denied and this family's going to be stuck with this bill, and you're going to be stuck saying, that probably wasn't medically necessary. So like, how is that actually going to help the patient? So I think it was great to get during training because it certainly gave me a different perspective when I was going through my medical training and now how I approach my clinical practice.
That's very cool. Very cool. You mentioned also that you've been leveraging your network to grow your business. I'm curious, you know, as we close out here, what's your advice on like specifically physicians trying to grow their network, whether it's, you know, obviously we all get to know a bunch of other physicians through med school and residency, but also, you know, maybe growing your network with, you know, either physician leaders or people outside of, you know, the clinical realm, but also that are relevant to, you know, what you're trying to do, you know, outside of that, if you will.
Absolutely. So I would say, and I think this is moving in the right direction. Previously, it was kind of frowned upon for a physician to be business-minded or have interests outside of pure clinical medicine or pure academic medicine, which I think is extremely unfortunate because at the base of it, entrepreneurship is just an expression of creativity, right? You have an interest or a passion and you are trying to develop a solution for that if there's some problem or issue that you identify. So I always support anyone in any walk of life, but especially in medicine, if you have that penchant for entrepreneurship, you should certainly pursue it and not let it go. For me, it has been fantastic to be able to express that early on and then meet like-minded people, you know, just through our group, I met you and it's been really great to see that you can still love clinical medicine, you can still love seeing patients, and it's not exclusionary if you have entrepreneurial pursuits. What I would say for anyone going through training is, you know, express those interests to your mentors, to your colleagues. And nowadays there are, physicians and business type of committees or groups that you can find in a lot of medical schools. And if not, feel free to start one, right? That's going to help you, again, meet different types of people. I have friends in all types of specialties who, you know, teach me different things, like different issues that never came across my mind. And it's helped me kind of get broader sense of how I could apply it to my own practice. So that would be number one, to express your interest in entrepreneurial business pursuits early on, and then find that support if you're still at your medical school. And if not, learn the steps to maybe start an interest group. The second thing would be, as a professional, right, we have our different academic societies. So I'm a member of AAP and ASEP, for example. They also have lots of committees and different groups that are more in terms of the business aspect of clinical medicine. I think once you get into those spaces and those groups, so it could be as simple as an E-list, you're going to start meeting people that are going to be able to refer you to someone. So I meet an ER doctor who maybe is mid to late career, and he says, yeah, you know what, I'm probably going to transition to some more consulting work. Here are some people I know in the consulting space who might be able to give you feedback on your pitch deck, for example. So by opening yourself up to meet people and network, it's always going to bring something back tenfold. So being open and taking that initiative is really important. There are different groups like Society of Physician Entrepreneurs that I'm aware of, that I'm a member of and was able to join. And just LinkedIn is fantastic for kind of figuring out what are your interests and where overlap and kind of other leaders in your field. So for me, it's in the entrepreneurial space, it's in the pediatric emergency space. It's in right now that I'm trying to focus on marketing and rebranding. Finding those leaders on LinkedIn is really important because I'm certainly no marketing specialist. So I'm going to have to get help in how to tailor my message to make sure that my visibility is increased and that I'm targeting the right audiences. So I think simply kind of going step by step in terms of having those clinical relationships and academic relationships, expressing your interest in business and entrepreneurship, and then stepwise making yourself known and finding these groups of physicians and other like-minded clinicians who have business pursuits is really, really critical. And always, always just being open to network. You know, some people say, for example, you know, okay, I'm in pediatric emergency medicine. What can an oncologist do for me or an orthopedic? You never know, because that person might have an entrepreneurial pursuit, and that could be a segue for you to connect with them and get not only advice and feedback, but also then another door could open to meet other people. So I think like most things in life, you have to be open, you have to take that initiative. And I think the first step is honestly being comfortable with saying, I'm a physician who has business interests, who has entrepreneurial interests, and then finding that support network through your academic center, colleagues, and just asking and looking online. There are now tons and tons of groups, and they can be extremely helpful in terms of helping guide you, get feedback, especially when you're very early on in your career.
I think that's excellent advice. I mean, being open to meeting new people and also I think that was a great point you hit on where, you know, maybe someone's a different field than you or a different focus than you, not automatically shutting that out and being open to that as well, and realizing that, you know, new and unique opportunities come in all kinds of shapes, sizes, and packages. So I think that's
absolutely
that's an excellent point. One of my last questions here is I ask everybody this: when you're not working on your consulting work or working in the ER, what's your passions outside, if to find that balance, if there is one?
Yeah, absolutely. My biggest 2 to 3 things that I do are travel. I love traveling. I've been to over 40 countries, so that is a huge passion. And it really helps me reset, clear my mind. It's fantastic to meet different types of people and kind of get perspective about yourself and just how the world works. So that's my primary thing. And then secondly, just being out and about, having fun. I'm pretty social. I love going to music festivals, art galleries, museums, anything like that with culture and the arts. Are really big for me. I'm a big foodie as well. I love eating. So I'm always down to try some new restaurants and different cuisines. So I would say those are the top 2 or 3 things that I very much enjoy. And it helps me be well-rounded and stay grounded. Don't take myself too seriously and still have some fun.
That's awesome. So I guess the last thing I want to give you a chance to, where's the best place for people to, you know, find you and connect, and then also find Premier Pediatric Solutions and find out more information as well.
Absolutely. So the best place to find me is on LinkedIn, Alana J. Arnold. I'll pop right up. I will have to say, I think it's a pretty nice headshot if I do say so myself. And so you can find me on LinkedIn. All of my information is there. You can connect with me also through our website, premierpediatricsolutions.com. We have an intake form, not only to schedule a meeting with us, but also you can actually do a pediatric readiness survey for free, just to give our potential clients a baseline as to where they score in terms of their pediatric readiness. And we can discuss that in our follow-up intake call. So LinkedIn, Alana J. Arnold, or you can find me on the web at premierpediatricsolutions.com.
That's awesome. We'll definitely put the links for that in the description for the show. And Alana, thanks again for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. Really enjoyed learning more about your career path and how you've built this business and how you're, you know, really changing, you know, pediatric care all over the place. I really commend you for your work. It's amazing.
Thank you so much, Maxwell. This has been excellent. I've really enjoyed my time with you, and thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Da Vinci Hour podcast, presented by Da Vinci Academy. Please be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow the podcast on your podcast platform of choice to catch the latest episodes. Please leave a comment or a review and share it with a friend. Lastly, you can find all of our podcasts, video courses, and books on our website, dviacademy.com. Thank you for listening.